bill we have in front of us is a historic gamble with the people's money.
The state Senate passes oil tax reform. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, March 21st. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a landslide remakes a mountainside near the Matanuska Glacier.
It just looked like part of the mountain just fell off. When you look closely at it, you realize that it was just sort of like an avalanche of rock debris.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2013 PFD, or paper applications are located in your community. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
A bill reworking the state's oil tax structure has cleared a major hurdle, passing the Senate late last night on an 11-9 vote. The package would effectively lower taxes on producers with the hopes of getting more oil in the pipeline. But without firm commitments to ramp up production, opinion on the legislation was split almost down the middle. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports on yesterday's debate and where things stand now.
If you had to tally last night's debate in numbers, a few would come to mind. 13, the number of amendments offered. 40, how many minutes the longest speech lasted. $6 billion, the number of dollars Alaska could forego in state revenue over the next 5 years if the bill passed. 90,000, the number of extra barrels that would need to be produced every day to offset that loss. For hours, senators went back and forth on whether that could happen. Supporters of the bill characterized it as a necessary risk that would make the state more competitive. Here's Senator Anna Faircloth, an Anchorage Republican.
It's time to act. Alaskans' future needs to be secured. Our generations, the next generation, depends on that.
Other members of the majority rolled out personal stories of Alaskans leaving for the promised lands of North Dakota and Texas, and they spoke of a need to pass a healthy economy onto their children. But they were reluctant to give specific numbers on the amount of oil they expect to see produced under the proposed tax regime, or give a hard time frame for when the state should see changes to the production decline. Meanwhile, opponents of the bill gave wonky treatises focused on the history of Alaska's tax system and the factors contributing to declining oil production. Senator Bert Stedman, a Sitka Republican, warned that a big hit to the state's treasury could affect the state's bond ratings and ability to secure low-interest loans for capital projects. Senator Hollis French, an Anchorage Democrat, listed the number of times oil companies have misled the state on oil taxes.
This is a bad bill that should be voted down. It's a giveaway, it's a crapshoot, it's a far, far cry from our best work and what we're capable of doing. I've watched each committee negotiate against themselves, waiting for some positive word from the oil industry. The words never came.
The bill that passed is a significant reworking of the state's tax code. Right now, Alaska has a windfall profits tax that requires producers to pay more when oil prices are high. This measure gets rid of that, while adding a higher base tax that's offset by a $5 per barrel tax credit. Just one amendment was made to the legislation. A measure setting the base tax rate on oil at 35% passed with the support of 11 members of the majority. An earlier version of the legislation would have kicked that tax rate down by a couple of percentage points after 2016. That would have meant an extra $300 million in state revenue lost at forecasted levels of oil production. In a late-night press conference after the Senate floor session, Anchorage Democrat Johnny Ellis suggested that amendment was needed to appease Click Bishop, a Fairbanks Republican who was seen as a swing vote.
They didn't have the 11 votes until Amendment Number 1 passed.
Majority leadership denied that this was the case. For his part, Governor Sean Parnell is happy with the bill. The original legislation came out of his office, and lowering the state's oil tax rate has been a consistent priority of his administration. He says he expects the legislation to start working shortly after it's put in place.
We should start turning things around in the near term, like 3 to 5 years, and that way we are not stuck long term without savings and little to no production.
The bill will now be considered by the House. The first stop is resources. Representative Eric Feige, a Chickaloon Republican who co-chairs the committee, says that he shares the governor's goal of making Alaska's tax rate more competitive. When asked if the narrow margin of the Senate vote would affect his committee's work, he said it would not. Republicans have an overwhelming majority in the House, and in the past, they've been more sympathetic toward the governor's oil tax reform efforts than the Senate. If they pass a bill with changes, it would have to be reconciled with the Senate version. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
President Barack Obama's nominee to lead the Interior Department, REI Chief Executive Sally Jewell, sailed through her committee vote this morning. It was unclear whether Senator Lisa Murkowski was going to try and scuttle the committee vote because of the dispute over building a road through the Eisenbeck National Wildlife Refuge. Residents of King Cove have lobbied for the connector road, saying traveling to Cold Bay by sea and air is often unsafe. Late last night, Senator Murkowski reached an agreement on the issue with current Interior Secretary Ken Salazar. APRN's Peter Granitz has the story.
Senator Murkowski has been threatening to filibuster the nomination over the Interior Department's decision to prevent construction of a road from King Cove to Cold Bay. The proposed road cuts through the Eisenbeck National Wildlife Refuge. Secretary Salazar has agreed to reevaluate the decision. That was enough to appease Senator Murkowski to allow the committee vote.
Sally Jewell will have the undeniable privilege of going to King Cove, and I'm going to be with her. We'll figure out when the best time of year is to get in and out safely. It may be that we have to fly into Cold Bay and walk.
A final decision on the road could be months, if not years, away. Interior will reassess the environmental review and include what Senator Murkowski calls the human component of the construction project. The agreement was announced as the hearing began, and not long after, the panel voted 18-3 to move her nomination onto the full Senate. The three no votes came from Republicans, including Wyoming's John Barrasso. He says he's concerned over Ms. Jewell's work on the board of the National Parks Conservation Association.
I've asked her whether she disagrees with NPCA's positions. She testified that as vice chairman, she was unaware of the organization's various positions and thus unable to say what positions she disagrees with. Well, that concerns me.
He's concerned that NPCA has sued the government to halt some energy projects on public land. Senator Murkowski says she'll take Ms. Jewell at her word, that Ms. Jewell will bring people of all stripes together, from the Interior Department and outside, to hash out areas of disagreement.
She says specifically that she is a convener. I need her to be a convener. We need her to be a convener.
That does not mean Senator Murkowski is a guaranteed yes vote. She says there are specific questions she has not gotten firm answers to.
I asked a very direct question on whether or not she would support putting ANWR into wilderness. And kind of I got the, well, I believe in balance type of a thing.
Seven Republicans voted in favor of moving the nomination onto the full Senate, including Idaho Senator Jim Risch. Risch noted the quirkiness of the cabinet confirmation process. Every state has its own King Cove. In Idaho, it's the endangered sage grouse. A major perk of being senator is the ability to threaten to filibuster a cabinet pick for a home state gimme.
It's really unfortunate that it takes a nomination like this and this type of a process in order to get urgency out of a federal agency.
Risch points out, even though he voted to move Ms. Jewell on to the full Senate, he can and may yet put a hold on the nominee. The Senate takes off the next 2 weeks for recess. It's expected to debate Ms. Jewell's confirmation in April. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Iditarod Race Marshal Mark Nordman talks about the death of a drop dog in Unalakleet.
It was a huge hit, a lot of emotions, for everybody that was involved, but it's still, you know, they're still feeling that.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Every day, people all over Alaska are discovering that public transportation can benefit their businesses and their communities. Public transportation in Alaska provides 7 million rides a year to work, medical appointments, shopping, school, and social opportunities. There's more information at alaskamobility.org. This message sponsored by the nonprofit organizations Alaska Mobility Coalition and the American Public Transportation Association.
A large landslide has transformed a mountainside near the Matanuska Glacier. Locals noticed the landslide in mid-February. It left a black streak of rock and debris on the unnamed mountain, at least a mile long. One expert says it's impossible to pinpoint what caused this particular landslide, but they are becoming more common in northern climates. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
Sheep Mountain Lodge owner Zach Steer first heard about the landslide when some friends drove by it on the way to his place. The next week, he was heading to Anchorage and took his camera along. The slide is clearly visible from around mile 94 of the Glen Highway.
It just looked like part of the mountain just fell off and slid down. And when you look closely at it, you realize that it was just sort of like an avalanche of rock debris. And it sort of conjures this image in your mind of this tumbling rocks and dirt and soil and trees and basically just a river of earth moving down the hill. And makes you really glad that you weren't there in front of it when it happened.
Russell Riddles feels the same way.
I mean, if you would have been there, you wouldn't be here anymore.
Riddles was driving down the Glen Highway with his wife when he first spotted it. He's a manager at the Long Rifle Lodge nearby. Riddles says there are some informal moose camps in the area, but he thinks they were spared by the slide.
One of the local kids hiked up there and said that the moose camp where one of the neighbor guys uses, it went right to the edge of it, actually knocked down the spruce tree that he hangs some of his stuff off of, but did not actually wipe out his little area where he goes to every year.
The landslide is on state land. The Department of Natural Resources knows about it, but doesn't plan to do any work to investigate it further. But landslide expert Martin Gertsema is very interested in learning more about it. Gertsema is a geomorphologist with the province of British Columbia in Canada. From pictures, he says the slide looks like a deep bedrock failure.
The deeper landslides tend to have delayed responses to environmental conditions. For example, if there was a warm summer or even a very wet summer, those effects are often delayed in these deep-seated landslides.
Gertsema says slides can also be the result of fatigue that builds up under a slope over centuries or even millennia. But he says large slides like the one off the Glen Highway are becoming more common around the world. He says there's evidence the increase may be linked to permafrost melt due to global warming.
I think warming is especially going to be important in places like Alaska and northern Canada and in high mountain regions around the world. You know, obviously, if you get wetter conditions, that will contribute as well. Like last year, Alaska had a tremendously heavy snowpack, and that triggered a number of large rock avalanches in the early snowmelt season, like La Tuya was one of them.
The landslide that happened off La Tuya Mountain in Glacier Bay National Park last June was the largest one ever recorded in North America. It ran for more than 5 miles down a wide glacier. Gertsema says no one knows how often big landslides occur in Alaska, but it's valuable to take note when they happen.
I think it's important to document them, and also it's important to figure out what the baselines are and how things are changing.
Given the vast wilderness areas in Alaska, Gertsema thinks a lot of large landslides in the state probably go undetected. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
To see a picture of the landslide, go to our website, alaskapublic.org. The new sports complex currently under construction at the University of Alaska Anchorage now has a name, the Alaska Airlines Center. UAA and Alaska Airlines announced the $6.3 million partnership today. APRN's Josh Edge has the story.
Though the new athletic facilities will bear the name of the airline, the money is dedicated to helping out with other aspects of UAA's athletic department. $1 million of the deal will go towards creating a new scholarship endowment for UAA student athletes. UAA Athletic Director Steve Cobb says there are about 200 student athletes at UAA, over 75% of whom receive at least partial scholarship support. Once the endowment is fully funded, it will yield approximately $40,000 in new scholarship money annually. Alaskans will have the top priority.
The way our averages are now, and most of our athletes are on partials, it would be seven additional athletes we would be able to give our average amount of aid to.
Currently, the average amount of aid the athletic department awards is a little less than a half scholarship. The remaining $5.3 million is slated to assist with travel costs for the 13 athletic programs at UAA. According to UAA Vice Chancellor Megan Olson, those costs are as much as three times higher than schools in the lower 48.
The travel itself is such a big part of the athletics program budget. The partnership that Alaska Airlines is providing and their sponsorship helps to relieve that burden. All of our athletes have to travel extraordinary distances in order to compete.
The new arena is scheduled to open in the fall of 2014, and Steve Cobb doesn't just expect it to give a boost to the athletic department, but to the community as a whole.
Very soon, everybody's going to come to the Alaska Airlines Center for one reason or another, whether it's a graduation, a lecture, a concert, a game, or some other event. I think in this about probably 2 years, you'll be hard-pressed to find anybody in the state that hasn't visited that building.
Cobb also says the new facilities will allow for some growth of the programs, which might even mean the addition of men's and women's soccer teams in the future.
The big decision here, anytime you add because of the tremendous cost of each program, but we also have an obligation to meet the needs of the state. And so that's the first thing you look at, are there unmet needs of the state? And the fact is we are exporting talented student athletes that like to play the sport of soccer, and they don't have a chance to stay here.
The new deal will officially start on July 1st of this year and includes an option to renew it for an additional 5 years. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
South Central Alaska sport fishermen are applauding a move by the state's Board of Fisheries aimed at ensuring escapement goals for Kenai River late-run Chinook salmon. The board voted unanimously to approve substitute language for a proposal that would have triggered emergency management measures based on the run's failure to achieve a specific escapement goal of 15,000 fish. Ricky Gies, the Kenai River Sport Fishing Association Executive Director, says the new language approved by the board raised the escapement goal.
The substitute language modifies the escapement goal. It puts in the new sustainable escapement goal from 15,000 to 30,000 into the late-run Kenai River King Salmon Management Plan.
The board did not take any further action on the issue. The board had considered various proposals dealing with management of the Chinook run that would have affected in-river commercial set net and commercial fisheries, but the panel has decided to leave those proposals until the next round of meetings in 2014. The Iditarod race marshal is calling the death of a dropped dog in Unalakleet this year one of the worst tragedies in the race's history. The Iditarod Trail Committee has since launched an investigation into what happened. They're working with the dog's owner to develop better dog care standards for the future. KUAC's Emily Schwing reports.
Over the last week, Iditarod Race Marshal and Director Mark Nordman has been in discussions with the race's head veterinarian, as well as rookie musher Paige Drobny, about what could have been done to prevent the death of Drobny's dog, Dorado.
You know, right now I still stand by our program. I stand by my head vet. It's something that we have to learn from. Anytime you have something tragic like this, you got to learn from it.
When Drobny pulled her team into the Unalakleet checkpoint more than 700 miles into the race, she knew she had to leave Dorado behind.
Well, Dorado had been sort of stiff on his front end since Ofer. I had vet check him over, and they couldn't find anything wrong with him. He started to just get a little bit stiffer as it went on. He wasn't having as good of a time anymore, so I just decided in Unalakleet that he didn't need to go anymore.
Dorado was scheduled to fly back to Anchorage with a group of other drop dogs, but high winds and blowing snow grounded commercial flights, and more than 130 dogs remained in the checkpoint for more than 3 days. The majority of the dogs were moved inside, but Dorado was among 30 that were not. On the morning of March 15th, Dorado was found buried in drifted snow. Preliminary necropsy results show the dog died from asphyxiation. Since news of the death broke, the Iditarod Trail Committee, or ITC, has faced scrutiny about the organization's ability to provide quality dog care along more than 900 miles of remote trail between Anchorage and Nome. Some of that scrutiny has come from mushers, including Paige Drobny.
I did a great job taking care of my dogs. You know, the vets that are out there are doing their best, but I don't know them all. There was a lot of them.
Race logistics along the Iditarod Trail are complicated. Nearly all of the checkpoints are accessible only by air. It's difficult to move more than 40 veterinarians around so they can see dog teams repeatedly.
I don't know even if I saw one vet twice. I mean, and because it's my first year, I didn't know any of those vets, and so I didn't get to develop a relationship with any of them.
With the exception of the head veterinarian, all race vets are volunteers. They do have to apply for the position, and they must be licensed. They also attend a series of trainings and workshops hosted by the ITC prior to the race. Mark Nordman says paying vets may not make a difference.
So I wouldn't say that paid veterinarians are going to be any better than they would not. In my opinion, they would not be better, because these people are here for the passion of the event and the dogs.
The ITC released a list of three major changes they'll implement to improve care for drop dogs. They plan to build boxes to house dogs in the larger hub checkpoints of McGrath and Unalakleet. They'll arrange for more frequent flights out of checkpoints, and veterinarians will also patrol drop dog lots more frequently in the future. Drobny calls the changes positive, and Mark Nordman agrees.
You know, if you're not trying to improve, then you shouldn't hold a position in any venue that we deal with, you know, and I think that we see that our care of the dogs is improved as far as, not so much our care, but what we've learned from the dogs. It just continues. It's just an evolving process.
Nordman has been involved with the race in some capacity since 1983. In 30 years, he's never seen an incident like this.
It was the biggest hit I've ever had in all my involvement with Iditarod, whether I was racing the 5 times that I did. You know, it's something that once the events start, my position kind of oversees all things Iditarod, and it was a huge hit. A lot of emotions for everybody that was involved with it, and it's still, you know, they're still feeling that.
Drobny acknowledges that her dog's death is likely one of the worst tragedies in the Iditarod's 41-year history. She says she and husband and fellow musher Cody Straith haven't decided if they'll enter another Iditarod.
We were saying that it might be nice next year for both of us to run the race together with Dorado's ashes and take him back out on the trail and go to those dog drops and to see those changes implemented would be kind of a cool thing for the two of us to do.
The ITC will continue to look into ways to further improve dog care. Further necropsy results for Dorado are due out within the next 30 days. Reporting in Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
The Iditarod is over, but there's still racing left to be done this season. The Kobuk 440 out of Kotzebue is scheduled to start April 11th. One musher is taking a long route to reach the race. Chuck Schaefer, formerly of Kotzebue and now living in Willow, is driving his dogs from Nenana to Kotzebue for the race alone. Schaefer did the trip last year as a way to save the expense of flying his dogs north for the race, but this year he's taking time to stop and talk with young people in villages along the trail about personal responsibility and self-pride.
I'm Inupiaq, and I'm traveling through Athabascan country right now. And I'll be in Inupiaq country here in a few days. It kind of has to do with roots and identity, you know, and I want kids to feel good about themselves. And other things work into that, you know, the responsibility of doing what I'm doing. It has goals to set and goals to attain and things of that nature. And feeling good about yourself, I guess, would be the way to sum it up.
It seems unusual for someone to go on a trip of this length alone. Was this more common years ago?
You know, I'm not so sure about that because I could remember my dad you know, of course, he had a big family to support, and a lot of times he'd spend, you know, 2 weeks, a month gone, just hunting for the family. And they would normally travel in groups, anywhere from probably, you know, at least a couple people to a half a dozen mushers to go out hunting and get what they needed and come back home. My gig, as far as traveling alone, I don't necessarily like to do that, but it's good in the fact that I have the equipment to do that. I build these special UHMW training sleds, and I thought, geez, you know, I can put a couple of weeks of dog food in the sled plus my gear, so I'm all good. And that's how it turned out.
And how do you train for a trip of this length? And has the training that you've done proven to be enough for this trip?
Well, actually, this is a training trip, but I do train, you know, with the intent of running the Iditarod one of these days, and hopefully, if financial things go the way it's supposed to, I'll run the Iditarod next year. So I basically train for something like the Iditarod anyway.
Are people in villages surprised to see you coming in alone?
Yeah, they are a little bit. You know, it's kind of unusual, I guess. Not many native people do this. In fact, I think I'm the only one that does this. And so that makes it even more special. But, you know, the equipment I have, like I said, it enables me to do something like this. So when they come over to check me out, of course, they greet me, and they look at the dogs, and they're more interested in the sled that I'm traveling with. So, yeah, it's all good.
Chuck Schaefer is driving his dogs to Kotzebue, where his wife Tracy will run the team in the upcoming Kobuk 440. He's heading for Galena from Ruby tonight. You can find a link tracing Chuck's progress at our website, alaskapublic.org. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage and Emily Schwing in Fairbanks. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau, Peter Granitz from Washington, D.C., and Josh Edge from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the University of Alaska Anchorage, where a freshman computer science course sparked a six-figure career in digital game design. The University of Alaska Anchorage, amazing stories being written every day. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Anchorage. Parents, be a hero to your kids. Make time to be physically active as a family. Encourage your children to participate in the Alaska Healthy Futures Challenge at their school. All kids need to do is be active 3 times a week and keep a log of their physical activities. They'll feel great and get cool prizes, too. Go to playeveryday.alaska.gov to find out if your child's elementary school is participating in the Healthy Futures Challenge. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority was created by the Alaska State Legislature to develop, stimulate, and advance the economic welfare of the state and further the development of public transportation systems. The authority has completed required environmental work to date, and the Federal Highway Administration has given its approval needed to move forward. There's more information at KinnickArmBridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.